Hi, this is Elaine Warner Hudson.
And Sarah Stuchel. And welcome to the Imagine Show for Project Josh. Tonight we have a special guest, Wes. He's here to share his experience surviving a heroin overdose. And you are listening live on AdviceRadio.com. If you want to call in with questions or comments, the call-in number is 562-945-2777.
Wes, it's so great to have you here.
Thanks.
For our program.
Appreciate it.
It's our honor. We were talking a little bit last week about, well, actually we talked the whole program basically about my son Josh, who passed away from a heroin overdose about 4 years ago. And this week we have the honor of being with Wes, who survived a heroin overdose, and we want to talk to him about what that was like.
So why don't we get, do you want to start with a little history, a little background of his, maybe your journey with drugs, how you got started with drugs, or do you want to introduce yourself?
Yeah, sure.
How old you are, if you're in college.
Yeah, my name's Wes. I'm a sophomore at a UCSC, and I started using drugs when I was 16 or 17, smoking pot and drinking, of course, like everybody does. And I don't know. I guess the reason I started was that I always had a low-key anxiety problems that would get really bad sometimes. I'd get panic attacks and just kind of generally feel on edge a lot of the time. And I don't know, some kind of ADD-like symptoms too. It was a mix of things. And
were you ever prescribed medication for those?
Yeah, I was put on a couple different types of antidepressants in a sequence. When one wouldn't work, they'd try another one, and I didn't feel like anything worked, but I always felt like drugs helped, and as long as I could, I don't know, as soon as I started doing it, I kind of felt like that was the answer to stopping a lot of intrusive thoughts that I had in my head, and coping with boredom and some of the other symptoms.
Wes, could I ask you what you started out using?
I started smoking pot, and then I started after that I would I tried ecstasy and psychedelics, and it's pretty casual, it's pretty tame for a while. I'd take painkillers every once in a while, but it was just whenever it came along, and it wasn't a big deal at that point. And eventually, after I got to college, I ended up becoming good friends with my drug dealer, which was a really bad decision, because that kind of thing gives you access to a lot of drugs. And I don't know, that was something I was really focused on at the time. And at that point, I tried cocaine and heroin, and got into other stuff like ketamine, and I don't know, pretty much down the list as far as everything goes. And
how prevalent were drugs at your college campus?
They're pretty prevalent at UCSC. There's not a lot of frat life. There's not as much binge drinking or things like that as there were at other colleges. You know, not that doesn't go on, but there's a large portion of the student body that smokes pot, and I don't know, a lot of hippie type people. You know, maybe not true hippies, but at least people who have that mindset. And
what about in high school? How were there a lot of drugs in your high school?
Yeah, I came from kind of a rich suburban community, and that leads to a lot of kids with a lot of money and not a lot of things to do. So there was a lot of drugs there too.
Did you use drugs, but mainly by yourself or with others, or did it vary?
It varied. It was both, and it just depended if I was in the mood or what I was in the mood for, I guess. But and also on the drug, you know, pot and stuff like coke. Those are social drugs, and you know, it's a lot more accepted to ask someone if they want to, you know, smoke a bowl or do a line or something like that than it is to ask them if they want to shoot up with you or something, you know. So it just depends.
So tell us about your drug use leading up to your heroin overdose.
Well, I don't know. At the beginning, it was mostly a smoking heroin rather than shooting it, which I think is how most people start. And I don't know, I felt like it gave me a freedom that I hadn't really felt from doing. That's my button. I think that's my button. I don't know. I'd never really felt a lessening of my anxiety or the mental just stuff, you know, not voices in my head, but just like, you know, thoughts that would bother me that I'd ever felt before. And it's something that kind of sticks with you even after you know, when you're not doing it, when you're sober, and makes you, I don't know, it just, you can't stop thinking about it after you start doing it if you have that kind of addictive personality without addictive drug. And it was okay for a while. I got into a lot of trouble doing drugs and being stupid and partying too much, and I got suspended from college for a while, for a couple months, or for about half a year. And that was a really bad time, but I stayed away from heroin at that for that period of my life, and had problems with other stuff, but didn't really get back into it until I started up my sophomore year. And I don't know, I attribute a lot of my problems to egregious use of pot and the lack of judgment that contributes to someone who already had poor judgment skills. And
so would you say that pot is a gateway drug?
I guess so. I mean, it's anybody who gets into hard drugs is definitely going to start with pot, you know, in my opinion. And I feel like if they're going to get into hard drugs, they're going to get into hard drugs, whether or not they, I don't know. I suppose it is, but I think it's not gonna push people into doing hard drugs unless they already have an addictive personality. But if they do, it definitely starts the process of getting there, to be sure. But
so what happened the night of your overdose, or tell us about that?
I don't know. I've been shooting heroin for maybe a month at that point. I've been smoking it, which was a really bad decision on my part, because it's a lot easier to overdose that way than smoking it. And I don't really have good memories of that night, but I was told that they found me in my bed and that I was having trouble breathing. And when I got to the hospital, the doctors were really, really uncertain that I would even make it through the night. and my heart was beating really slow. And because of that, a lot of blood just ended up pooling there, and I got a clot, which they were worried that might break off and enter my brain, and that I would stroke out or I don't know, do damage in some other way. And it ended up cutting off a lot of oxygen to other parts of my body, and eventually they cleared it up with anticoagulants. But in the time that I was not breathing at the proper rate and having blood block from going where it should be, I sustained some serious brain damage and damage to my kidneys as well. I had to be on dialysis for a while after that. And I don't know, that night they I don't have any memory of that because I was in a coma for 5 days after they took me in, because they put me under, so I wouldn't be conscious of I don't know, the pain I was in or what was going on. But they called my parents, and they told them that they told them that I probably wasn't going to make it at that point. And they had a priest come in and give me my last rites, and a whole bunch of really scary stuff happened. And
who found you when you said that they found you? Were you with friends?
No, I was by myself. I was in my bed, passed out. My roommate found me, thank God. Or otherwise, I would be dead without a doubt right now. And it was really lucky that he noticed that I wasn't breathing right and called somebody.
How long were you in the hospital for?
I was in the hospital for about a month, and it was really difficult because due to the brain damage, I couldn't. The part of my brain that either messed up my inner ear, or literally my inner ear, or affected the part of my brain that dealt with balance and coordination. And so I couldn't really walk for a while. I had to use a walker, and couldn't really go anywhere by myself. And I lost part of my hearing because of that. That is, it's not going to come back. And I had some really, really serious nerve pain in my left arm because I was lying on my shoulder for the period that I was passed out, and I was out so I was passed out so hard that I didn't realize, you know, that I was lying in a really uncomfortable position. And the doctors, they took 15 doctors and tried to figure out why my left arm was so messed up, and they couldn't figure it out. And they came to the conclusion eventually, because they couldn't figure out anything else, that because of the way I was lying on it and for the length of time I was lying on it for, that a bunch of lactic acid had built up and given me a chemical burn from under my skin. And it did some really serious nerve damage, and I was in really bad pain. And ironically, they were giving me some serious painkillers in the hospital to deal with it afterwards, right after a heroin overdose, which they eventually ramped down. It still hurts really bad right now. The doctors told me it'll hurt for probably a couple more months because nerves heal about an inch a month. And I've been told that I might have chronic pain for the rest of my life. And I lost a lot of function in my left arm, which will hopefully come back, but that's again another maybe. I can't really grip anything right now, and it's hard to move my fingers individually, or I don't know. But it could have been worse. I I could have really easily died. So I'm gonna. I don't really mind all that other stuff in light of what could have happened, I guess.
Do you want to share with us some of the photos you brought from that day?
Yeah.
That?
There's a picture of the wound that I got in my left arm.
Wow.
And my skin kind of bubbling there.
So you were intubated.
Oh, yeah.
And we'll have these photos up later on projectjosh.org. We'll start a little blog and post some of these so you can see what this looks like, what we're looking at here. Wow.
Yeah, I was on a breathing machine for a while, and I didn't like that, apparently. I bit off part of the tube, and I had to get another one, and, I was not doing well at that point.
Looking at these pictures, it's a miracle that you're with us today.
Yeah, no, that's a... I was kind of surprised when all the doctors were coming by and just, you know, looking like really surprised and happy, just saying, you know, it's so nice to see you up, and I didn't get it because my parents hadn't really explained to me at that point how close I'd come to dying, but, yeah, it was, all the doctors just told me it's absolutely a miracle you're alive, and you would have been dead if you were any older and your heart hadn't been as strong as it was, so.
Now, had you had, overdoses prior to this?
Yeah, I had one overdose, on meth when I was, living in San Jose, and, when I was suspended and going to community college, and I was away from my friends and really depressed and just trying to manage things, and I thought I was going to have a heart attack, and, that's the only one that comes to mind, but no heroin overdoses before.
So this was your first heroin overdose?
Yeah.
And how long, again, had you been using heroin? Intravenously?
For about maybe a month and a half at that point.
Okay.
And I'm not really sure why I decided I needed to graduate to that step, other than that I knew that got you higher, and you didn't have to use as much heroin to get where you wanted to go, but... I mean, logically, I'm not really sure why I decided that was what I needed to do.
So where are you at now with all of this? With your drug use, with your life? Where does this leave you?
I'm immensely grateful to be alive, for one thing. And, I don't know, I mean, it's made me a... And it's taken a lot of the glamour away from drugs for me, especially based on the fact that if I went back to that, all of my faculties are messed up to the point where if I did overdose again, it would probably kill me. And it's taken a lot of the addict out of me, I think. Not that that's supposed to ever leave you, if you believe what they say, that, you know, once, you know, if you're an addict, you're an addict sober, and you're an addict if you're using. But,
do you believe that?
I believe your mindset stays like, I mean, if you have an addictive personality, you have an addictive personality, but I feel like it gets seriously magnified by drugs, and, I feel like the choices you make if you're a current active user are a lot worse, and it just makes the demons it just magnifies them to a point that they become uncontrollable without drugs.
So what are you doing now? Are you in sober living?
No, I'm at home with my parents right now, doing physical therapy to try to get my arm working again, and I don't know, just trying to maintain at this point.
So you actually at one point couldn't walk.
Yeah. Yeah. My balance was really, really messed up. And
it's amazing looking at you. I can tell you're a brilliant young man just from you talking here. And I think there's a reason why you're with us today. I think we got some big things to do in this world.
Yeah, no, it's made me a much more spiritual person. I wasn't I was spiritual before, you know, and I wasn't religious or anything. When the priest came in and he asked my parents, you know, what religion did he ascribe to, and you know, what should I say for him? Like, there it is. He doesn't, you know, he's spiritual, but he doesn't have one. But I was so close that I don't know. It's given me a lot more faith in a higher power, and I always had serious doubts about that before, but it's given me a lot. It's made me think about that a lot more, and
it's really beautiful to hear that.
Thanks.
There's a lot of strength in that. So now, are you experiencing cravings at this time?
Yeah, I had one today. I started thinking about it. I hadn't had one in a while, but
for heroin or a different drug?
No, for heroin, and I don't know. It's a.
So how did you deal with that craving?
I just kind of sat with it, watched some TV, and tried to distract myself.
So explain to our parents out there who maybe aren't familiar with cravings and don't know what they are. I mean, can you go into like what a craving is like for you?
It's a, I don't know, it just kind of starts out as a thought, and it turns into like a serious longing emotion for whatever your drug of choice is that you're craving at that point. And I don't know if it doesn't really even need to, you know, your kid doesn't need to have been in drugs for a long time to experience that. You know, it's, people get into drugs because the first time you do it, you remember that feeling, and you know, it's so pleasurable, your brain locks onto it and just burns it into your neurons, and you can't forget that. You know, if you can't forget the first time you got drunk or the first time you got high, just it doesn't leave you, and especially if it's hard drugs, it just stays with you for you know, forever, you know. And you just think about the feeling, you think about the process, what it looks like, you know, all the everything associated with it, you know, the good parts and the bad parts, and just you know.
Do cravings scare you?
Yeah, they're uncontrollable, and you can't, they're really hard to force out of your head, you know, without, you have to find something to distract yourself when that happens, and it's, that doesn't always work, you know.
So do you also feel a lot of anxiety when you're craving?
Yeah, you know, because especially now when I know that I really can't go back to it in a way that I couldn't, you know, but in a different way than I couldn't before. And, you know, especially thinking about how that would just make things go away when, you know, usually you get them when things are bothering you, and you just, it's hard to think about how much that would just push everything out of the way and just calm you down.
So tell me, what's a typical day like for you?
I don't know. Right now, they've been really slow and kind of sleepy because I'm still on painkillers for my arm, which is, I don't know, nerve pain is really hard to combat, and really, really painful. So I've been moving kind of slow, and I've been spending a lot of time sleeping. And being in pain makes you sleep a lot too. So I don't know. I've been taking it easy. coming off of, you know, what happened. But right now, being at home, I've been doing a lot of physical therapy on my own, trying to just watch movies and work out my arm and get it back to the point where it functions again. And spend a lot of time meditating and trying to, you know, get my natural highs in, and trying to start working out again. I recently just regained my ability to start running, or not running, but at least, you know, working out on an elliptical machine or, you know, treadmill stuff, and just trying to get out of my head in any way I can besides getting high at this point.
And I don't think you mentioned what date this happened. I was just curious how long ago this took place.
It was on January 5th, I think, of this year.
Wow, that is just amazing looking at you.
Yeah.
How far you've come.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They told me I could have really, really easily been a vegetable or had a serious stroke or, I don't know, some horrible things. They said I almost had to take my arm off because it was a... They couldn't figure out. I think it was a subdural hematoma. I was bleeding from somewhere in my body, and they couldn't figure out where it was, or something like that. And they almost had to amputate my arm. A lot of really serious, scary shit happened. And yeah.
Well, we're getting ready to go on a break here.
We're on 1680 AM Advice Radio, and we'll be back in just a couple minutes.
When people say you're bright, they mean you've got a lot going on up there. It's not something people who use drugs hear much, because over time, drugs can change their brain. And the more times they try drugs, the more they want them. It's called addiction, and it's a disease that will waste your brain. For information, visit StopDrugAddiction.org or call 1-800-729-6686.
Huh? You talking to me? All right. I'm supposed to tell you that, hello, I'm supposed to tell you that whenever I listen to AM 1680, I enjoy acting up with Skyler and Steve, although right now they're not acting up too much because I broke both their legs. Thank you.
Visit us online for show archives and more at actingupshow.com. Follow us at twitter.com/actingupshow.
Hi, everyone. This is Tony Aiello. Hey, recently my wife was involved in a car accident, and thankfully she was uninjured. But our 2006 Corolla wasn't. It was a wreck. I brought my car to Advance Auto Body in Santa Fe Springs to get it fixed. And let me tell you, they did a great job. My experience with them was quick, efficient, and their quality? Well, let's just say I couldn't even tell our car was involved in an accident. In a state-of-the-art facility, the team at Advance Auto Body are collision repair specialists, and they work with all the major insurance carriers. They're family-owned and operated, and they've been serving the La Mirada area since 1994. You can call 562-802-1215 or stop by and say hi to Francis and Jerry. They're located right up the street from Valley View Avenue at 14,000 Rosecrans Avenue. That's 14,000 Rosecrans Avenue in Santa Fe Springs. Advance Auto Body, 562-802-1215. That's 562-802-1215 for Advance Auto Body, your collision repair specialists.
Lifestyles, I'm Deborah Wetzel. Every bride wants to look beautiful on her wedding day, and achieving that perfect look is easy with some expert advice on the right beauty products. Kelly Kwan, celebrity makeup artist, says a little preparation can make the day go a lot smoother.
Being prepared is the key to pulling off a gorgeous look, so select products that can multitask. For example, choose a creamy lipstick that doubles as a blush, and use petroleum jelly, which adds shine to lips or can be dabbed on hair to prevent flyaways.
And since brides spend most of their big day smiling for the camera and guests, how should they keep their smile looking luminous?
Prior to the big day, get in the habit of brushing with a battery-operated toothbrush to remove surface stains and a paste that restores whiteness to teeth. These are also great tools to bring along for quick smile touch-ups in between the ceremony and reception. Also, be sure to choose lipstick colors that have a blue or cool undertone, like a mauve or pale rose. These will make a bride's beam look extra white through all her wedding day photos.
I'm Deborah Wetzel.
There is a way to avoid pesticide use. This is Nick Fedoroff with today's Things Green Garden Minute, but first. Believe it or not, there is a way to avoid the use of pesticides, insecticides, and all the other sides that are toxic to you and I. And it's really simple to do if you follow through properly. First off, start with healthy plants in and around your garden, as well as your houseplants. A plant that is healthy will ward off any insect or disease, so that means you're going to need to stay on top of fertilizing and correctly watering your plants so that the immune system of the plant does not deteriorate, therefore encouraging this kind of activity. Another practice to keep on top of is deadheading spent flowers. Once a flower has provided the color and the beauty that it had to offer, you need to get rid of it. Clearing away fallen leaves and debris is another way to deny pests of a place to live. And finally, mechanical control such as hand picking and using barrier traps is a great way to avoid pesticide use. This is Nick Fedoroff with today's Things Green Garden Minute.
Someone who says that's so gay. Turn it around. Did your mom cut the crust off your peanut butter and jelly sandwich? That is so gay.
Oh yeah? How would you like it if I said that so guy who makes fun of other people's sandwiches mostly because he's secretly jealous of them and who also has ketchup on his face?
Okay, jeez. Sorry. Wait, do I seriously have ketchup on me? When you say that's so gay, do you realize what you say? Knock it off. Learn more at thinkbeforeyouspeak.com. Brought to you by Glisten and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to our program, Imagine. I'm sitting here, I'm Elaine Warner-Hudson, with my co-host, Sarah. And we have a guest today, a very special guest by the name of Wes. I'd also like to mention that we'd like you to check out our website. It's www.projectjosh.org. A lot of valuable information on there. That is where you'll go to look to see all of these scans that Wes brought in. And these are amazing. You really need to go and check these out. I look at this and I'm amazed that he's sitting next to me in this room. And I have to say, it just makes me want to well up with tears because looking at you, I would have to say I would think that you probably wouldn't have had much of a chance of survival, like they said.
Yeah, nobody thought I had a chance of survival at that point.
So what does survival look like to you from this point forward? What's in your game plan? Are you over drugs? Are you thinking you can still use? Where are you at with that?
I'm over hard drugs as a rule, and I don't know. It's hard to think about stuff like alcohol and marijuana because it's so such a large part of college life, and I don't know. I've been trying to avoid thinking about that aspect of stuff up till now, but I don't know. I think, you know, if I felt like I could learn to control it, you know, there's a funny thing about Charlie Sheen today about how he was saying that he was over cocaine completely, but if he you know, felt like he wanted to have a glass of champagne to celebrate, that it'd be okay for him, and that he didn't ascribe to AA or anything like that. And I don't know. If I felt like if I got enough time sober, just, you know, minding my P's and Q's and focusing on stuff that I needed to focus on, I think that might be okay. But I need to feel absolutely sure of myself, and, you know. think about it a lot before.
Do you remember what it's like to be sober?
It's been a really long time having any kind of stretch of sobriety under my belt. You know, even when I stopped using drugs, you know, I was on antidepressants, and that's a whole other world of strangeness in itself. So, not really. I can't say.
Do you have plans on going back to college?
Yeah, I do. Trying to hook up with some people who are not along the lines of people I was hanging with before, and trying to find some people who don't have the things I used to have as part of their daily life. And I know there are people like that out there. It's just hard to. It's just not that many in college, because everybody's, seems like everybody, you know, the old cliche that everybody really is doing it, you know. It's funny, you know, it's like these squares that I know from my high school who are going to college now, and to my college, and it's funny, because, you know, even they're getting into drugs, and it's just, I don't know, it's just, it amazes me, you know, just how prevalent it is.
I think it's really important to remember that, just what Wes just mentioned about drugs, because they're everywhere around us. We brought that up last week at our first program, that they're in the medicine cabinets at home, they're on the internet, they're on the streets, they're everywhere, and very easily accessible. I'm sure, Wes, you would agree with that, right?
Yeah, that's where I first, it's the first place I found any kind of real opiate was in was exploring my parents' medicine cabinet and finding a packet of Percocets, you know, and yeah, it's absolutely true, absolutely everywhere.
So you have no memory of what it's like to be sober?
I wouldn't say no memory, but I think I've tried to block a lot of those memories out subconsciously and consciously, because those were painful times for me. And
do you see yourself being sober? I mean, do you have a vision of what a sober life for you would look like? What you would be doing instead of drugs?
Be doing I don't know, I'd be pursuing interests that I had put aside for a while, because I hadn't been able to maintain the willpower to practice at them, and had just kind of given up and started using drugs out of frustration.
So, Wes, what are some of your interests? I'd like to know about those.
And I was really, really into yoga before a lot of this started, and I still was during it, and I played basketball for 10, 12 years at least, I played a little guitar, I did karate for a while, I got a black belt in Taekwondo, and did a little bit of MMA, and I don't know, I was kind of an English nerd, I used to read a lot, and I'd like to start doing that more, because I kind of... It's kind of hard to do that and maintain focus when you are high all the time. So, yeah, that about sums it up.
What would you say you are passionate about in life? What's your passion?
I have a lot of passion for English. As far as, I don't know, I've always thought that a career as a writer or just anything in the writing industry, you know, publishing or something like that would be just an amazing, you know, and a dream job, you know. Always thought it'd be fun to be a musician, but that's also just an incredibly competitive field, and I always felt like I had more natural talent at writing than music. You know, I know a lot of people are just, like, innately talented at music, and I kind of wish I was, but it seems like my path lies more along words than music, but I always thought that'd be really cool too.
Sounds really inspirational. Really inspirational. That would be wonderful. I could see you as a writer. You seem like a creative young man.
Appreciate that.
So do you find, what hardest times of when you're thinking of using, would you say when you're by yourself, alone, or is there any particular time of day?
Oh, it's definitely when I'm by myself and, I don't know, anxiety kind of wells up for me, and I'm sure for other people who have it, just whenever it chooses to without rhyme or reason. I mean, sometimes there's a trigger, something that reminds you of something, but a lot of times I think it's just something subconscious that you don't even realize, and you see something or you hear something that reminds you of something, and it just starts a chain reaction, and I don't know. I guess a lot of times when I'm trying to go to bed, you know, at night, but, you know, being with people helps, definitely helps distract me, and, makes it easier because you don't want to look anxious or have anxiety attacks in front of people, and it just helps you just deal with it, and kind of, I don't know about repress it, but find a way to avoid having that happen.
I want to go back to the passion for a second here. Do you think that if you plugged in to your purpose or your passion in life, that would be enough to keep you sober?
Yeah. I don't know. For writing, for me, at least when I do it, it doesn't feel like I need anything else. I mean, I don't even think about needing drugs or feeling anxious or any of the problems I have or I think I have. It just kind of, I don't even consider it. It just, I kind of go somewhere else. It's, I don't know, it's a lot like drinking, but, you know, without the alcohol.
So it's a healthy outlet.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, anxiety certainly did play a role for Josh as well. I don't know if you heard the program last week, but Josh had like a two-hour bedtime ritual every night because of panic attacks and anxiety and getting himself settled into bed. And Sarah, we've talked a lot about that, about anxiety and how that actually pertains to drug use.
Yeah. We mentioned last week, you know, anxiety probably has an 80 or 90% coexisting or correlation with substance abuse or self-medicating that anxiety. So it's very common for people who have general anxiety, panic disorder, OCD, any spectrum of anxiety disorders to self-medicate with street drugs. So that's important for families and teens out there struggling with anxiety to know, to be aware of.
Yeah, I don't doubt that. It's it's just, I don't know, it messes with your head so much that you really stop thinking about the consequences even. You know, I was a serious athlete before a lot of this happened. I did basketball and track and, like I said, karate and a lot of other stuff, and I was really conscious about what I put in my body and being healthy. But once I started doing drugs, it just kind of, it all kind of went by the wayside. Like, you know, even if I still ran or worked out or I did stuff, it was, I don't know, there was always that there that would take it away quicker, you know. And you just kind of stop thinking about the consequences when you know something's there that will work that quick and that effectively.
Have you tried, I mean, or did you try when you were at college to work out for your anxiety or get back into running or any of that?
Yeah, I did. I would do that even when I was, you know, still using and, you know, just trying to counteract the effects as I knew I was slipping deeper into it.
Did you ever have thoughts about wanting to quit using drugs before this overdose?
Yeah, no, I definitely did. It was It's not an enjoyable thing. People. A lot of stoners, a lot of druggies, you know, idolize people like Hunter S. Thompson, people like that who are, you know, in the movies who are high all the time and, you know, always, you know, just cavorting and, you know, the madness of insanity of drugs and how much fun that is. But I don't know. Hunter S. Thompson ended up being a really, really depressed, messed up person when he got to the end of his career. People say that, you know, he's a great writer, but the last 15 years of his writing, he didn't have anything good come out. It was all kind of, you know, he was past his prime, and attributed a lot of that to drugs. And you know, it's I was always, you know, I wished I could stop before, but I didn't really have the willpower. And
do you have it now, after going through this?
Yeah, I feel like I do, but you know, that's, you can't really say that. It's kind of something you need to prove, and it's only something you can prove by staying sober, or at least away from the really bad stuff.
So at this point, could you say that you're willing to go through any length to stay sober?
Yeah, it's a. It's so completely not worth it. It's not even funny. I wish I hadn't picked up, you know, gotten anywhere near as deep as I did at all. And I take back a lot of the fun times I did have. I would take back a lot of that to just have avoided the brain drain that I can feel now, and just the physical damage that I know will come back to bite me later in my life.
So if your parents wanted to send you away to treatment for a year, would you go?
I don't know that I would. I've spent time in treatment before, and I'm not sure how much I believe in treatment. I think it's sort of a scam a lot of ways, and I spent time doing 12-step programs and things like that. Well, I think they do have there is a lot of wisdom behind it. It's a.
So what's your ideal treatment center?
it'd be something where you weren't chained and you felt like you were a prisoner in a facility, and you got to do fun stuff that was of your choosing, and you know, not what the program thought was fun. You know.
If they required you to be sober.
Yeah. No,
you'd still go if it was a fun thing to do, if you were doing fun activities, maybe traveling, exploring classes like art classes, cooking classes.
Yeah.
Ski trips.
Yeah, yeah. No, I had a relative who had a pretty serious drug problem too, and she counted the time she spent she spent a year in a wilderness program, a serious wilderness program out in the boonies, and she counted that as like the happiest time in her entire life, because you know, they are outside in nature and doing stuff, and you know, I don't know the rehab I was in, I just felt I did feel kind of like a prisoner, and you know, I didn't feel like it was therapeutic. I just felt like it was forcing me to be sober, you know.
What was missing? I mean, why are rehabs a scam, in your opinion?
I don't know. They cost tons of money, and there's such a ridiculously high, you know, relapse rate that I feel like if they actually worked, that the relapse rate would be a lot lower. You know, I know it's like one in 10 for just drug users in general who have addiction problems, and like 1 in 30 for people who are getting to opiates. And I don't know.
Let me ask you, we have a program with Project Josh, and that is a sober companion program, Guardian Angel sober companion program, basically where we help you go out into the world, find jobs, learn to have fun again, and you're with someone, and you have that buddy with you every day to do these things. Do you think that might be something that might help?
I do. I mean, a lot of people think that, like I was saying before, that, you know, it'd be fun to just be high all the time and live fast, die young, that kind of philosophy. But people who think ignorantly or think that that'd be fun because they don't feel like they have any other choice to find enjoyment in this life, because there's just something, there's something there, that something blocking them, something in the way that doesn't allow them to do that. And I feel like a lot of addicts don't enjoy drug use. I think they feel it's something they need to do. They see it more as a ritual, like a duty that they, it's not like other people do with drugs, when it's just, you know, it's not the same mindset. I've seen a lot of good writers, who are really into drugs, because a lot of writers who are into drugs say that, you know, it's, the reason that people get into drugs is because they don't have a driving passion, or they can't access that passion enough to get away from the destructiveness of serious drug use. You know, that if they wouldn't do that.
I was going to say that Josh had a problem after he became sober, and the biggest problem he had was learning how to have fun. There's another young man that passed away a couple months ago that I was very close to as well, and he told me exactly the same thing, that it's hard to know because you're so used to the euphoria of the drugs that it's hard to find a way to just have normal, everyday fun. So Project Josh is working on a program for that, and you can look up our program and our website at www.projectjosh.org. Read about it. And we all have as well, once again, Wes's pictures that he brought in for us that are just remarkable. There's a lot to be learned today from this with you. Mm-hmm. I think it's a miracle. You know, I lost my son, but it's no coincidence I'm sitting with you here today. And I think you talking to everyone, you certainly have touched at least one person's life today. I guarantee you that.
I appreciate that a lot. Thanks.
What was it like for you to come today and share this with our audience?
I was happy to do it. It's a... people talk in AA, NA all the time about the therapeutic benefit of one addict helping another. They say that all the time. And it's absolutely true, you know, because a lot of people look at drug addicts as really selfish people, and I don't feel that's the case at all, you know, at least in my personal experience, and a lot of the drug addicts I've met along the way that I feel are really spiritual people, but are just so smart and care so much about things that they really can't deal with the world on its own terms, because the world is such a harsh, unforgiving place, and just, you know, can't deal with the things around them and get into that to escape from it, you know.
Yeah, that's something I wish we had more time to go into, but I agree with you. I think a lot of people who get into abusing drugs and alcohol are really good people, spiritual, happy. They have a lot to offer the world, but the world does seem very harsh to them, and so they use drugs to cope with that harshness.
I agree, Sarah. I think most of them are the most beautiful people in this world. They're the most sensitive, warm-hearted people alive. And I think that the world is just very harsh, and they have a difficult time. And therefore, they want to medicate.
Mm-hmm. Any last-minute thoughts or comments, Wes, on what you've been through, or any advice for our audience? Anyone who might be struggling with drugs?
I have so many regrets about things I've done, not just time I've wasted, you know, not just brain cells I've wasted, but just, I don't know. The fact that there's a lot of permanent damage that I really can't erase at this point now, and just, you can't see a picture if you're, you know, on the inside of it, you know, if you can't look at.
Can you forgive yourself?
I have a lot of trouble doing that, but, it's easier now that I'm sober, and, I feel like it's a lot of people have trouble forgiving themselves for whatever they think they've done, and drugs just perpetuate that problem and make it worse in the long run. And to anybody out there who is struggling with a serious drug problem, I'd say if you don't feel like you can get sober completely, that at least spend some time and look at it and see how much better you feel when you're not, you know, deep in the trenches of, you know, fighting yourself, and look at it and look at your regrets and try to forgive yourself for it, because I feel like a lot of addicts have trouble with that. And
I would love for anyone that wants to email to survivingmother@projectjosh.org to do that, because I would like to know how many people heard Wes today and his beautiful story. I'm so thankful that you're with us. You're a beautiful, wonderful young man. It's such a privilege to meet you today.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for coming on and sharing your story and bringing your photos, and we'll have those online at www.projectjosh.org. And I guess this is it. We are wrapping up. We are done for today. We're on adviceradio.com. And again, we will be live on Thursday at 11. And the call-in number for next time is 562-945-2777. Thanks.
Thank you. See you next time.
Thanks.
The next time you take a cool drink of tap water or watch a flock of geese heading south toward the fall, you may want to give a nod of thanks to our nation's farmers.
People, thank you!
Not only do they feed us, they help keep the land healthy and the air and water clean. They produce habitat for our wildlife and scenic landscapes for all of us. Making up about 2% of the population, farmers and ranchers care for about 70% of our land. Every time we buy a loaf of bread, or admire a beautiful landscape, or take that drink of clean water, we reinforce our connection to the land and to those who care for it. America's farmers and ranchers.
God bless all of you. Have a pleasant weekend.
Did you know that every time you buy a gallon of gasoline, you pay a little over 18 cents in federal gasoline taxes, or about $2 per fill-up? Many people may not realize this, but the federal gasoline tax was devised as the fairest way to pay for needed road and bridge repairs by having those who use our roads pay for their upkeep and repair. But lately, federal lawmakers have been using money from the gasoline tax to pay for non-highway programs. As a result, many needed road and bridge repairs aren't being made. The Road Information Program, or TRIP, a nonprofit transportation research group based in Washington, D.C., says more than $6 billion a year in revenue from federal gasoline taxes now go into the general fund. Tripp says that money could be used to make needed road and bridge repairs if lawmakers would put all the money from federal gasoline taxes into the Highway Trust Fund. Once it is in the trust fund, Tripp says the money could be spent to help improve traffic safety conditions, reduce traffic congestion, and improve overall road and bridge conditions.